Ots on a flatbed that had been gotten running. She was a trifle taken aback by the enthusiasm that greeted her. She was not used to being a celebrity, and she did not realize that she had given the Scots an element called for in their romances. Everywhere she went, Scots, no matter what they were doing, rushed over to her, stared at her with glad eyes, and then rushed back to the work of getting the place handled. There was still a war on, but they could cheer and their pipes could skirl, and they could delight in the successful rescue of a fair maiden. But Chrissy, even though busy and very tender with the wounded, felt a suppressed terror that she masked. Johnny was not here, and she somehow knew Johnny was not all right. Scots, under the direction of Angus, were trying to get the tumble and jumble of forklifts operating. The whole hangar door was blocked solid with wrecked planes, and they could not move any planes out. They told a worried Robert the Fox it would be hours before they could get forklifts running and get to work on that pile. Turl tried to manage a last ploy. He got to see Robert the Fox by saying he had something urgent. They brought Turl up with hoist chains wrapped around him and held in four different directions by four brawny Scots, while two others held assault rifles on him. He told Robert the Fox that he had keys to the drone presets and would exchange them for a promise of an early teleportation back to Cyclo. Robert the Fox said yes, if Turl could produce the keys. Turl thereupon asked for his boots. A female Cyclo, who said her name was Chirk, had been found in a breathe mask under the bed in Turl's old quarters. So Robert the Fox went to her where she was being held under the spotlights of an otherwise wrecked mine car, and asked her whether she was Turl's secretary, and she readily said yes, she was. So Robert said he had a message from Turl for her to get the preset keys of the drone. Chirk had had lots of time to think, since Zut sailed off on the drone for reasons of his own, and she had finally remembered about the keys. She got very cross and sent back the message that Turl must think she was very inefficient. He knew very well that he had given her a set of keys and told her to drop them in the recycling trash bin. And that had been ages ago, and the keys were long gone, and if Turl was trying to blacken her company record by saying she disobeyed orders, she could do a little blackening on her own. There was something about promising her a huge home on Cyclo. She was very cross. So Robert the Fox called for Turl's boots and examined them and found a false sole. He removed from it a very thin, small blast gun. Right now, Turl was chained up with four separate chain strands in a well-lighted field with an assault rifle on him. He kept snarling something about females. The compound was a litter-strewn bedlam of lights and noise. There were hundreds of Cyclo bodies lying around in everybody's way. Everything was soaking wet. The Chamco brothers had gladly contracted for 15,000 credits a year, with a 500-credit bonus for each major job. They were a little apprehensive about a counterattack from Cyclo, but pay was pay. They were laboring with the team of Scots to get radios back into operation, but it didn't look like they would earn 500 credits right away. Water had saturated a lot of equipment, and the transshipment area was a write-off. Nobody could get a plane out into the open where its radio could broadcast, and Glencannon's ship radio was just fused metal. Robert the Fox walked up and down, his old cape flowing. He answered where he had to and gave orders where needed, but his mind wasn't on it. The 12-hour radio silence was up, and he was out of communication on the planetary band. He could not order the ships that had attacked the remote mine sites to go look for the drone. He had no ships to send. He went over to where about 20 wounded Scots were laid out in a field, being handled by the parson and schoolmaster and four old women, and Chrissy. His eyes and Chrissy's eyes met. Robert the Fox felt very bad. Johnny had been right. It would not have done to wait for mine-site-bound ships to attack the drone. They had left long before it fired, and they knew nothing of it, and he could not even tell them. He had a feeling Johnny was in trouble. Robert the Fox gave his head a slight shake. Chrissy looked at him steadily for a moment, swallowed hard, and then went back to work. 2. Zut felt triumphant. The animal had been hurt, and hurt badly. It could have been better. The roll of the drone had caused a slight miscalculation in the throw, and instead of totally severing the animal's head as he intended, the plate had hit a strut of the plane skids and then had struck the animal. But the results had been very satisfactory. There was red blood all over the floor plates under there. The animal had fired a new, small weapon up the corridor. But in the mirror, Zut could see that the animal was passing out, coming to for an instant, and passing out again. Zut had waited. The animal would pass out long enough for Zut to dart forward and finish it. However, it didn't quite come off as Zut had planned. The animal had crawled backward toward the back end of the drone, halting and firing a shot, backward further, firing another shot. It had crawled into a canister loading hole in the rear cargo space. The hole it went through was almost too small for it. It disappeared. Zut waited a long time and nothing else happened. Finally, he crept out of his recess and, ducking into other recesses and using his mirror, got all the way back to the rear cargo bulkheads. He tried to look in with the mirror. It was too dark in there. He shone a torch in there. Nothing. The animal must have crawled off to the side. Zut tied the torch to the mirror and looked to the right. He got one very short glimpse of the animal, and then a bullet hit the torch and mirror, and they went flying out of Zut's hand. Lucky he hadn't tried to reach in there himself. He listened all along the bulkhead. The roar of the drone was too great to hear any breathing. For quite a while he expected the animal to pop out and shoot, but nothing like that happened. He finally concluded that the animal had crawled in there and died. There sure was enough blood. Bled to death, probably. Zut beamed happily. Well, enough. Zut decided he better get to work. He opened the door of the battle plane and switched on the local command channel and tried to wake up Nup. The dimwit certainly must be up there. Maybe asleep. Zut impatiently threw on all the radio channels. That would blast the nincompoop out of his wits. Planetary had a habit of knocking in ear bones at just a few hundred feet.
Nup, you crap brain, wake up!
Nup's voice came back.
Who's this?
Look, Nup, said Zut with controlled patience. I know you are short on sleep. I know they didn't teach you the exact solution to all this in mind school. But I feel that under the existing circumstances, you might try to cooperate.
Is this Zut?
What a dimwit. What a flutter brain with its bearings burned out.
Of course it's Zut.
And you're down in the drone? Ah, I thought you were. But didn't Snit fly you out? If you were...
Shut up! Roared Zut.
Here's exactly what I want you to do. Take off and land that ship just above this door. Land it close to the edge above the door so it will break the wind.
Nup wanted to know break the wind from what? Zut told him very unpleasantly. Nup, with 10 minutes of fuel left, hastened to comply. Zut intended to rob this damaged battle plane of its cartridges of fuel. He had been appalled at the skill it would take to fly it out this door. Then he had a happy thought. Maybe it carried some spares. He got up on the seat and started to rummage in the back compartment. A whole bag of cartridges, dozens of them. But he saw something else. His breathe mask exhale ports flashed. This stuff had radioactive dust on it. Of course, this wasn't surprising for packages that had been in a radiation bullet battle, and it was not much, but it frightens it. He flung the bag of cartridges out into the passageway and jumped out to stop them before they rolled into open spaces. Holding them at arm's length, he shook the bag. He breathed on it cautiously. No flash. Good. He opened both doors of the battle plane. He wouldn't go near the back compartment. He did everything now at arm's length. He played a torch on the housings of both main drive and balance motors. His practiced eye detected a hairline crack in the right balance motor. Maybe it would run, maybe not. The crash hadn't helped. He reached underneath it and got a paw full of wires and tore them loose, scrambled them, and laid them back unconnected but out of view. One battle plane that wouldn't fly straight. Good. He got down under the plane and looked at the drone's main drive. Ah, there was his wrench. And the animal hadn't removed the plate. Good. He put the wrench back in his boot where it belonged. The pitch and roll of the drone changed drastically now. Nup had moved. The pitch was gone, but the roll was much worse. However, it all had its good points. The drone was now crabbing and protecting the door from the wind. Gingerly reaching for the microphone, Zut stood well away from the plane.
"You in position?" he demanded.
It took a couple of times, but...
"All right. Do you recognize a cable ladder?"
Nup tried to explain that as a mining executive and a fully qualified pilot, he of course could recognize...
"Fasten your end of the cable ladder to the cleats opposite the seat. Drop the weighted end of the ladder down here. Then lower an ornet on a line. And then a safety wire. All into this door. Got that?"
Nup said he certainly understood it, but was there ore in the drone? He didn't quite understand.
"Fuel cartridges. I'm going to send you up fuel cartridges."
"Oh my, that's a relief. Will they fit?"
Zut didn't bother to answer.
"Of course they fit. All plane fuel cartridges were interchangeable. It was tanks to planes that didn't match."
What a crud brain. The ladder's weighted end came whipping down. It fell on the wrong side of the tail that was jutting out of the door. The tail was wedged over. Zut, feeling quite brave, reached in, waited for a correct roll of the drone, released the magnetic brake, shifted the plane with a massive heave only a cyclo could manage, and reset the brake. Good. Now he could get the cable ladder end where it belonged. He had clearance between it and the door edge. He lashed the lower end to a floor beam. The lowering safety wire gave trouble, for it kept flying out into the wind stream. Zut radioed Nup to haul it back. Devil with it. He didn't need it. Zut reached into the battle plane and pulled out a coil of safety wire from it. Then he couldn't figure out how to use it. He tied it to the battle plane in its proper ring, but he didn't like the idea of being tied here. Suppose the plane moved or something. He left the safety wire on the floor plates. Devil with it.
"Ore basket," he demanded of Nup.
It came down. It was heavy enough not to fly around in the 300-mile-an-hour blast of cold air. As Zut tied the cartridge bag into it, he realized he hadn't inspected it for fuel. It probably also had ammunition cartridges in it. Well, who knew? They might need both. As soon as they flew off, he was going to gun this interior, blow this battle plane to bits, and just make sure.
Damn animal. Damn Turl.
A new thought hit him. It was a long way down. He better grab the jet backpack. Very gingerly, he reached an arm into the compartment and got it. There were two there. He brought out both. He threw one over the side and put the other on. Left the animal with no out. But of course the animal was dead. And good riddance.
Damn, Turl. "You all set?" he demanded on the radio.
Nup said he was, but where was the fuel? Zut let him pull up the fuel in the ornet.
"You got it?" demanded Zut.
"Yes, I'm trying to check. Just let me remove the spent empties and make sure the size..."
"Blast you for a dim-witted crud. Stand by to steady that ladder. I'm sick of being down here in this crap-infested, monkey-cursed drone. I'll take care of the refuel when I get up there. Don't put an ammunition cartridge into the fuel sleeves. I'm coming up and right now."
But he didn't come up right now. He looked at the radio and then took his wrench out of his boot and slashed the radio to bits. Of course, he'd be shooting this thing to pieces in just minutes, but caution was always best. Zut grabbed the cable ladder rungs and started up. He looked up. It was not a short climb. The Mark 32 cut off the wind stream quite a bit, but it was still a strong blast. He paused, made sure his mask wouldn't blow off, and climbed up the ladder. 3. Johnny lay on the cross members of the canister storage area of the drone, gripped in a nightmare. He was in the cage again, a collar around his throat, and a demon was crushing in the back of his skull. He kept trying to tell the demon he would shoot it if it didn't stop, but he couldn't get the words out. He wrestled himself up from the nightmare. The roar of the huge drone engines beat against his head. He realized where he was. It wasn't the collar, it was the neck lanyard of the revolver. The heavy weapon was hanging down between the beams. He painfully retrieved it. There was a small amount of light in here, and he swung the cylinder open. Just one shot left. He reached to his belt to see whether he had reloads. He didn't. The blast gun was lost. Before he passed out, he had opened the first aid kit and tied a wound pad over his head and under the face mask straps. That was all he remembered after he had shot the flashlight out of Zit's hand. He could see it gleaming still, bent over a crossmember. No, that wasn't a flashlight. It was about 4 feet away, and it seemed 40. What was it? A mechanic's mirror. So that was how Zit observed him. What had awakened him? How long had he been out? Seconds? Minutes? The back of his head felt like it had been staved in, soft to the touch. Fractured skull? Or was it just swelling and blood-matted hair? He heard something clatter. Noise around the plane had awakened him. With a sudden feeling of urgency, he made the effort and retrieved the mirror. He slid along the crossbeam and put the mirror to the hole. It was Zit. His first impulse was to dart out and use this one last bullet. Then he saw the ladder end, and the ore basket going up. They were refueling the Mark 32. The sudden thought of what they could do with the Mark 32 back at the compound shocked him fully alert. He knew what he must do. Just now, wait. That was the hard part. He kept drifting off into a murky black sea of unconsciousness. He could hold on for a while, but the wave would drown him again. Zit was on the radio. No, he was smashing the radio with the wrench. Johnny gathered himself up, tensing to dive out through the hole. He watched carefully with the mirror. Zit went over to the ladder. He started up. He stopped with just his legs visible below the door. In a wave of pain, Johnny got out of the canister loading slot. There was a safety line on the floor plates. He grabbed it and gave it a tug. It was secured to his plane. In his condition, he did not want to lapse unconscious and fall out that door. He rapidly swung the safety wire around his waist and secured it with a hasty loop. Zit's legs were gone. Johnny checked the revolver to make sure the one shot was going to come up under the firing pin when he cocked it. He swung himself onto the ladder. It was blowing outward from the drone. The bottom end was fastened inside the door, but he was now out over empty space, protected from the wind stream by the tail of his battle plane. He went up several steps. Johnny had a clear view of the Mark 32. The cockpit lights were on. The door was being held open by Nup's foot. Zit was a third of the way up to the plane. For a moment, Johnny thought he was too late. He thought Nup had hoisted the fuel cartridges out of sight. But no. Nup had the caps off the fuel receptacles and was examining them. For numbers? And he had the whole ore basket in his lap. Zit was howling at Nup, something about opening the door wider and steadying the cable. Zit climbed further. The ladder was protected by the angle of the Mark 32, but there was still a tearing wind. It was ripping Zit's jacket. He roared again, something about opening the door, the words lost in the roar of the drone and the scream of the wind. Johnny cocked the revolver. The face mask protected his eyes. He could have shot either Zit or Nup. He didn't. He carefully allowed for wind and elevation. The already high muzzle velocity of a Smith & Wesson 457 Magnum was increased by blasting caps in its cartridges. He must be very careful. Only one shot. Nup kicked the door further open, the ore basket in plain view on his lap. Then Nup saw Johnny and yelled and pointed, and Zit looked back down. Johnny fired. He tried to duck back inside an instant after the shot. He was not quite fast enough. Enough fuel and ammunition for 20 battles not only went up, it also flashed down into the open fuel and ammunition receptacles. The roar and almost instantaneous concussion hit Johnny like a sledgehammer. He went outward over black space. The safety line held and snapped him back inside the door. In that confused instant, as though it were a still picture, he saw Zzt on fire just starting to fly out into space. He saw the whole Mark 32 leap in an exploding ball high in the air. Johnny hit the floor plates just inside the open slots so he wouldn't slide back. The concussion had been too much for his head, and he was passing out again. An idiot phrase passed through his mind just before a deeper darkness blanketed his senses. Old Staffer was wrong. I'm not too smart. I just cost myself the only target search beams can pick up. The drone was not rolling now that it had been relieved of its unstabilizing weight. The body on the icy floor just inside the door did not move. The lethal cargo soared onward toward Scotland and the rest of the world, its goal the final obliteration of the remainder of the human race, the ones it had missed 1,000 or more years ago. 4. The small boy sped on feet of fire through the underground passages of the dungeons of the castle. He was soaked with the rain that fell outside. His bonnet was askew. His eyes were glowing with the urgency of a message he had carried for a 2-mile sprint through the dawn twilight. He identified a room ahead and tore into it, shouting, "Prince Dunaldin! Prince Dunaldin! Wake up! Wake up!" Dunaldin had just settled down in his own room, in his own plaid blanket, for a nice comfortable snooze, his first in quite some time. The small boy was wrestling with excited hands to light a candle dip with a ratchet flint device. So it was Prince Dunaldin now. They only called him that on feast days or when somebody wanted a favor. His uncle, chief of Clan Fergus, was the last of the Stuarts and entitled to be called king, but he never made anything of it. The light was burning now. It shone upon the sparsely furnished, stone-walled room. It showed the rain-drenched, excited, black-eyed boy, Bitty MacLeod.
"Your squire, Dwight? Your squire, Dwight, has sent a message? Who he say is most urgent?"
Ah, this was different. Dunaldin got up and reached for his clothes. Squire, Dwight. Probably Dwight had used that because co-pilot would be an unknown word to this child.
"Your gillies are afoot, a saddle and a mount. Your squire has said 'twas most urgent."
Dunaldin glanced at his watch. It meant that the 12-hour radio silence was over, that was all. Probably a babble of news. Dunaldin had no idea at all that things had gone other than successfully at the other mine sites, or that they'd succeeded at the compound. He got back into his flight clothes. No hurry. He took his time. What a busy night it had been. His and Dwight's plan had been to bring the chiefs across the sea to celebrate the victory. They had landed both ships on a flat place 2 miles off so as not to shock the people, and he had borrowed a horse from a startled farmer he had known and ridden in. He had gotten his uncle, chief of Clan Fergus, out of bed, and gillies had flown to light the fires on the hills to gather the clans to hear the news. The mine site in Cornwall was no more. They would be free to roam the whole of England. The chief was very fond of his nephew, Dunaldin, who was, in fact, his heir. He liked Dunaldin's style, a true Scot. He had listened enraptured as Dunaldin had given him a thumbnail but torrential account of all their doings. And if Dunaldin were a bit incautious, the chief gave his attention while making very sure to reserve judgment and act in a wise way, on the general scene, without spoiling Dunaldin's flair. So he had ordered the beacons lighted. He was cautiously thrilled. Dunaldin had then gone to see a lass and had asked her to marry him, and she had said,
"Oh yes, oh yes, oh yes, Dunaldin."
That attended to, he had come home for a nice snooze. Bitty seemed to be trying to remember something else. He was hopping from one bare foot to the other, squinting up his eyes, wiping at his nose. Then the boy seemed to abandon his effort. Dunaldine was almost dressed. The boy's eyes caught the sword on the wall. It was a claymore used in battles and for ceremony. It was a real claymore, 5 feet long, not just a basket hilt saber. Biddy was gesturing at it, indicating the prince should wear it. Dunaldine shook his head to signify no, he wasn't going to take it this time. When he saw the eagerness die in Biddy's eyes, Dunaldine relented. He took it down and handed it to him.
All right, but you carry it.
The sword was a foot taller than the boy. Worship, awe, and joy sprang up in the boy again as he draped the hanger around his neck. Dunaldine checked his gear and went out. The castled passages and halls were aswarm with gillies. They had Lochaber axes in their belts and were bustling around with 100 chores in preparation for a gathering of the clans. Dunaldine had really thrown a firebrand into the scene. Nobody had been briefed. They didn't know what was going on. Dunaldine had come home. Orders had been given. Somebody said the Cyclo mine site was no more. There was an awful lot to do. The ancient ruin had remained a ruin above ground so as to attract minimal attention from drones that had gone over for centuries. Some said the place had once been the seat of Scottish kings. Its dungeons had been expanded, and it was a fortress in itself. Two gillies had Dunaldine's own horse saddled, and it was prancing about. The gillies were smiling broad welcomes to Dunaldine. He mounted, and at a signal they tossed the boy up behind him, Clechamor and all. It was raining. A storm apparently had moved in. It had been clear when they landed, but now the dawn was thick with overcast. It was at that moment that Biddy MacLeod remembered the rest of the message.
"Your squire," he said to Dunaldine's back, "also say to squiggle?"
The boy's accent was thick, not the accent of an educated Scot.
"To what?" demanded Dunaldine.
"I misremembered. I couldna think of the word," apologized the boy. "But it did sound like squiggle."
"Scramble?"
asked Dunaldine, the word that meant emergency takeoff.
"Ah, so 'twas.
Dunaldine was off like a shot, and 2 miles were never eaten up so fast by a horse. They came plunging to a stop on the flat-topped knoll. Dunaldine looked wildly about. Only the passenger plane was there. He flung himself off the horse and flung the reins to the boy. He opened the door and leaped into the passenger plane, reaching for the radio. And then Dwight landed nearby, startling the horse into frantic plunging that lifted the boy and the sword off the ground at every rear. Dunaldine raced over to Dwight.
"It's gone now," said Dwight.
There had been no radio messages from the compound. Dwight, as arranged, had faithfully stayed on watch. He had waited for any break in radio silence and the end of the silence itself. The time period had ended, but pilots, not hearing from the compound, and Robert the Fox had not opened up. But something else peculiar had happened. Dwight had picked up a cyclo conversation on the planetary plane band, very loud and clear. It seemed loud enough to be within 1,000 miles or so, maybe more, hard to tell.
"What did they say?"
demanded Dunaldine.
"I got it all on a disc,"
said Dwight. He started the disc. It said,
"Nap, you crap brain, wake up."
Dwight said he had at once sent the boy to tell Dunaldine to scramble, and then he himself had gone straight up. Yes, the sudden roar of Dwight's own engines was there on the disc. The disc played on.
"Drone,"
said Dunaldine.
"Zut. That was a transport chief named Zut."
"Well, he was out there someplace in a drone,"
said Dwight. He had gone up as high as he could, about 200,000 feet, as fast as he could go.
"Almost tore my heart and lungs out with gravity,"
said Dwight. Then he heard complete instructions in Cyclo about re-landing on top of a drone in front of a door so Zut could get out of the drone.
"There is no drone that big," said Dunaldine. "Not that I know of."
Dwight had turned on every search instrument he had. The transmission had been coming from the northwest. He had sped in that direction. He had gotten it on his scope. It was traveling 302 miles per hour, a very positive blip. It was clear weather where the thing had been. This cloud cover and rain was ahead of it. He played some more transmission. Somebody named Snit was still in the drone, but no explanation why. This was mad because drones didn't have pilots. But how could anybody fly anybody out of a drone? And then somebody was taking fuel out of the drone in an ore basket, and the other cyclo said he was leaving the drone.
"Then why are you here?"
demanded Donald Dean, turning toward the passenger plane.
"Why didn't you attack it?"
"It blew up," said Dwight. "I saw it visual, eyeball. It looked like 30 lightning storms. It curved down. It probably went into the sea. I scanned the whole area. There was a little blip left. Probably when it sank, it had some debris. And then that was gone. It just isn't out there anymore on any scope. So I came back here."
Donald Dean played the disc through again. Donald Dean pulled out the instrument recorders. They told the same story. Heat and then gone. Donald Dean looked at the sky.
"You better go back up there and patrol in that direction."
"There won't be any blip," said Dwight. "And this overcast is high. The thing was flying at about 5,000 feet, and you won't be able to see a thing visually. The overcast goes up to at least 10. There's no blip," finished Dwight.
Donald Dean turned and looked at the castle ruin, gaunt and very old in the morning rain and mist. 2 miles away, and it was drifting in and out of visibility. What was that all about? Had the battle of the compound been lost? What drone? And why had it blown up? The clan chiefs would be assembling, and he had a lot of things to do today. 5. Johnny drifted up out of a pit of black pain. He tried to orient himself. The drone motors were like shouting anger in his ears. His arms were hanging down into a gap in the floor plating. Blood had run along the sleeves and dried. With a start of alarm, he thought of Zt and reached for the revolver. It was gone. The lanyard snapped in the blast. The blast? Zt was also gone, and so was the Mark 32. And so was anything that would let this ancient monster be located on a screen. He lifted himself up with considerable effort. He was still tied with the safety line. He found it very hard to think connectedly, and he wondered for a bit why he was tied to the line. His back hurt, one more pain in a confused welter of it. He realized the safety line had pulled him back inside. It was awfully hard to think, and he recognized that he was getting worse, not better. He was nauseated. Hunger. It must be that he was nauseated from hunger. He got to his knees. The drone was no longer rolling. That was a relief. He turned and then stared. Through the door, bright tendrils of mist and fog were curling in. It was a storm. He was flying through a storm. Wait. It was light out there. Daylight. Well advanced daylight. How long had he been out? It must be hours. He spun on his knees, thinking to see the gas canisters dropping gas. He had no way to tell that. Were they already past Scotland? Had the drone already done part of its work? He got to the door and tried to spot a brighter area in the storm that might tell him where the sun was. It was too thick. He wasn't thinking well. He realized he had reverted to being a mountain man. There were compasses in the plane. He opened the door and saw the havoc Zut had made with the radio smash-up. It distracted him. Then he realized he had opened the door to look at the compasses and did so. When he leaned over, it felt like somebody was hitting his skull with a sledgehammer. He felt for the compress on his head. It was still there. No, the compasses. Look at the compasses. He was heading southeast. The course to Scotland would have curved over like that. He couldn't be sure. He went back to the door and tried to look down. He nearly fell. He couldn't see anything down there. All rain and mist. Then he remembered the ship had gas ports in the bottom. He crawled painfully to the floor plate he had removed and looked past the motor housings. No daylight was coming up. His air mask seemed to be suffocating him. He recalled it had been askew when he woke. Of course. The drone had dropped no gas yet. He'd be dead. Well, he wasn't dead. Pretty well on the way to it with this head, but he wasn't dead. Therefore, the drone had not yet dropped gas. Part of his trouble was that his air bottle was out of air. He got new bottles and put them in place. It made him feel a little less lethargic. He got a grip on himself. He was just dawdling around. What had he been at when he had been hit with whatever it was? Maybe he didn't have very much time. His industry faded when he recognized he didn't have the wrench anymore. He made himself think, to come out of his pain. He climbed down and checked the nuts on the inspection plate. They were loose, but it would take an age to unscrew each one. The threads were too many. He got into the plane and rummaged about. He found a bag of explosives and emptied it. He had 6 limpet mines, a long coil of blasting cord, some boxes of blasting caps. He looked for time fuses. None. He looked at the limpet mines. No time fuses, only contact buttons that would explode them when heavily jarred. No electrical cord. It was an awful effort to think, to concentrate on just one thing. What could he do with this mess? Straight contact? Suicide stuff. He found his own belt pouch, some flints, pieces of glass. Ah, a roll of long buckskin thongs. At least he could get the nuts off. Encouraged, he somehow got down to the inspection plate again. He did a binding wind for the first turn and then wound the thong around and around the nut. He tied a hand loop onto the remaining end. He braced himself and gave a heavy yank. The nut spun off, leaped up, and vanished into the dark hold. Even though the yank had almost torn his head apart, he repeated the action with the other 3 nuts. Gone. He struggled to lift the heavy plate. He had intended to just lay it aside, but it slipped from his gloved fingers and fell into the darkness of the drone's belly. Let it go. Now he was staring into the black interior of the housing. There were some small electrical sparks arcing in there. He knew very well you were not supposed to get into a motor when it was running, and certainly not put a hand to one. It was said it gave a paw a funny feeling like it wasn't there and then was and then wasn't there. One could lose a paw, Kerr had said. He painfully lifted himself to the ship again and found a spare torch and went back and shone the light inside the housing. There were all the thousands of coordinate points jutting out from the inside skin. They were smoothly arcing as they translated progressive space. It wasn't electricity, really. It was energy driven up to the arc point, and then these arc points did a conversion to space coordinates in terms of pure space. The electricity just kept little motors running behind the points. This thing must have thousands of sub-motors behind those points, and they could be damaged. It wasn't armored in there. The light shining into it looked funny. It was appearing and disappearing in a flutter. Well, a blast could wreck those translation motors and the points, flicker or no flicker. A small submotor was a small submotor, and a blast would disable them. The space converter wouldn't convert anymore, and this thing would simply go unpowered and crash. He didn't think the balance motors could support the mammoth drone by themselves. Yes, it would crash. He drew back. Leaning forward was bringing on the blackness again. He mustn't pass out anymore. That was final. He mustn't pass out anymore. In the plane, he gritted his teeth and stayed conscious. He had to work out a rig. Nothing but contact firing devices. What could he use to detonate them? The plane's guns. He would rig it so he would fire the guns and blow the plane backward out the door. An inspection of the battle plane gun panel revealed no damage. The console was not damaged. He looked at the housings of the plane's main and balance motors. Was that a scrap of wire on the floor? But when he leaned forward to see closer, he started to black out again and stood up. Time. He had better work fast. He might even be too late now and crash this thing in the hills with the gas blowing all over. This nausea was just hunger, that was all. He picked up some dried venison and lifted his mask. But chewing on it was an effort. It made him feel worse. What was he doing? He must concentrate. Not just his mind, but even his actions were wandering. He got a spare safety wire and started to tie the mines together in a long string. They had magnetic grips to hold them to hulls. He had asked for them, thinking he could drop them in a circle on top of the drone and blow an entry hole in. Useless for that, but he would put them to work now. A garland. Chrissy, when she was a little girl, used to make flower garlands and put them on his pony's neck. He was wandering again. He gritted his teeth and kept at his job. The manual had said, "Do not pack mines with contact fuses in such a way that the fuses can be subjected to closure by the weight of another mine." A vision of the cyclo belt buckle, as he had seen it many times on Turl, rose before him. The clouds of gas in the sky. How he hated it. A garland. He had the mines strung. He then took a long length of blast cord and wove it through the holes in the limpet bases that let the mines cling to metal. He hoped they didn't cling. Yards and yards of blast cord looped past the contact of each mine and up parallel with the safety wire. It was all so heavy, so very heavy, he was starting to black out again. He caught himself. He managed to get the long end of the safety cord through an upper I-beam support. Using its friction as a brake, he got the mines suspended over the inspection hole and lowered them carefully down into the housing. Down they went, deeper and deeper. Good thing this drone wasn't rolling or the mines would snap over to cling magnetically to the inside skin of the housing. Careful, careful, lower and lower. There was a sudden jerk. The bottom mine had hit the bottom of the housing interior. Good. No, not so good. Had the drone motor changed pitch, or was that just part of the murky sea of semi-delusion in which he was so slowly moving? Were the mines altering the space contour of the interior and affecting the motor drive? He didn't know. But there was no time. He tied the safety line fast to a beam. The loose long end of the blast cord he threw up over the upper structural bars. Ow, but that hurt his head. Was it in front of the plane's guns? Near enough. He got the blasting caps. Percussion, it said on the box in Cyclo. He started to fasten a single cap on the blast cord directly ahead of his guns. Then, with a burst of finality, he tied the whole box to it. He checked, thinking with difficulty. When he fired the guns, it would set off the caps. These would fire the blast cord, and that would fire the mines. He realized then it would have been smarter to have sealed it with the housing cover. He looked down into the depths. He turned a torch down there. Was it possible to recover the inspection plate cover and its nuts? But he forgot about that. His light was playing straight on the full intake cap. There were two caps. No, five tubes. Into these, he knew, would be stuffed hundreds of fuel cartridges, dropped in one after the other. A drone like this required an enormous number of cartridges. It must. Waves of nausea and blackness were hitting him. He mustn't tip his head over and look down. That was the secret. He wondered whether those big fuel tube covers would move. They were usually just screwed on. With difficulty, he got down to them. With both hands, he gave one a twist. It spun easily. Within a minute, he had five fuel tubes open, the covers clanging down into the dark belly. For a while, it wouldn't affect the drone, but if the blast fed into those open tubes, oh my. He checked everything again. The drone soared out. But not for long, he told himself grimly. 6. Not until then had Johnny thought about what was going to happen to himself. He had a feeling that it didn't really matter. He knew his head was staved in. He had lost an awful lot of blood. But he ought to make a gesture, some rudimentary effort, just to say he had. Say it to whom? He was out of radio contact. The drone was wave-neutralized to any screen. There was not the slightest chance of the drone being seen visually in this storm. Down under him would be sea, or an even less friendly mountainside, if the blast disabled his plane. Battle planes were pretty well armored, but firing his own guns in an enclosed space, plus the mines, plus the fuel of the drone, was going to make a pretty big bang. His jet backpacks were gone. He rummaged about in the back of the plane. He remembered not to lean forward. That's what blacked him out. A brief moment of hope. A life raft. He pulled it out. The automatic inflation cartridges were long since duds. It had a little manual pump. He started to pump it up. Orange-colored, some tinsel on it. Then he realized he was being stupid. If he inflated it, he couldn't get it back in the plane. He knew the plane would sink. He wouldn't be able to get it out. The wind was tugging at the half-inflated raft. A wave of blackness came over him, and the door draft casually flicked it out of his hands. It went away into the storm. Gone. It had all been a waste of time. He got into the plane. He had some blankets. He had been hurt in the earlier crash. The map case had not been enough. So he padded his knees and the windscreen with blankets. He realized he had not checked for loose objects. They were deadly. He took the blankets away and looked in the rear of the plane behind him. Littered. A backward jolt of the plane would have made them into projectiles. Wearily, he got out and began to chuck things out through the door. Clip after clip of assault rifle ammunition. A shovel, whatever that was doing here. A sample pick. Odds and ends. He snugged down the cable ladder and ornate equipment of the plane. He put the food bag and his own pouch under the seat. More nauseated than ever, he got back in the seat and restored the blanket cushions. He wrapped the oversized security belts around him twice and up so they would keep his head from snapping forward. All set. He reached out for the gun controls and put them on full barrage, flame, and ready. They were aimed at the box of blasting caps. Was the drone tilting or was he just dizzy? He couldn't tell with his dazed senses. He looked at the climb indicator of the plane. Yes, the drone was tilting, the door behind him lower now. Something had upset the coordinates. The magnetic fields of the limpet mines? But whatever it was trying to correct, it was pointing its door down. That meant if he shot backward and fired, he would be shooting himself toward the sea or the mountains. He better not delay. He kicked off the magnetic grips. The plane started to slide backward to the door. Hastily, he hit his starter buttons. The plane was sliding backward faster. He slammed his fist into the gun firing button. The battle plane fired full blast, but the result was far more than just gun recoil. Before his eyes, the whole interior of the drone flashed a violent orange and green. The battle plane was catapulted backward into space like a projectile. The shock of sudden motion almost tore his head apart. He could still see, still register. The drone looked like an old rocket missile must have looked. It was soaring upward as though the door was the jet. Johnny's hands fumbled over the battle plane console. He punched in coordinates to arrest his backward descent. With a jolt, the plane slowed its rocketing downward plunge. But something else was happening. There was no response from the right balance motor. In a slow roll, the plane began to rotate in the sky. The roll became faster. The left balance motor could not hold it by itself. Johnny frantically battered the console keys. The plane was now cartwheeling through the storm. 7. Badly shaken and feeling very ill, Johnny tried to control the plane. There was a thin spot in the storm. It was extremely hard to think. If he shut off the left balance motor, maybe the stricken ship would stop rolling. He managed it. Then he realized the guns must still be firing. He got a wad of blanket out of his vision and reached up to push the firing button off. And as he did, he saw it. the drone. Almost straight at him, it was tumbling out of the sky. Spent flames were licking out of the doorway, and a vast plume of smoke was trailing behind it. It was going to hit him if he didn't move. His hands hit the console. He felt the plane move. The drone went by so close, the plane tumbled again in the air rush. Abruptly, a geyser of water smashed upward into the storm, a column 200 feet high. The battle plane spun about under the new impact.
Water?
Water! Johnny felt a surge of relief. They were not yet over Scotland, still over the sea. Water. He would hit it. He knew that pressure outside the doors would keep him from opening them. This battle plane would never float. He brought a fist down on the window openers, both of them. He looked at the console. What could he press to arrest his own descent? The battle plane crashed into the sea. The jolt threw him back into unconsciousness, but in a moment, a wave of the coldest water he had ever felt rushed in on him, revived him. Bitterly cold water, colder than ice to the touch. And it was hitting him in a roaring torrent from both sides. He fought with the huge 10-pound cyclo belt release. Everything seemed to be moving in slow motion. He unwound the belt from himself. The water was getting darker. The battle plane must be sinking very rapidly, or he was passing out once more. The incoming rush eased. At least the plane was no longer spinning, he thought vacantly. A sudden surge of energy. He got to his knees on the seat and thrust a floating blanket out of his way. The futility of it struck him. There was nobody to save him. He couldn't live in water this cold. More by reflex than by intention, he went out the window and began to rise to the surface. His air mask tanks were lifting him. Water was getting in the air mask, washing dried blood off the inside glass. The sea became lighter and lighter green. Then a spatter of rain hit his head.
Rain. It was welcome.
The sea about him, as he floated face up, was a panorama of tossing, overwhelming waves, pockmarked with the rain. A wild scene. The cold was getting to the very center of his being. He knew he was going into a delusion again. As the waves covered and uncovered his ears, he thought he heard a voice. They said dying men often heard angel voices calling them. He knew he was very close to death. More delusion. Hopeful thinking gave rise to false sights. It was what he would have dearly loved to see, not what was. But the water-blurred vision stayed there. Something hit him in the face mask.
A line?
He became more alert. It looked like Dunnell Dean on a cable ladder not 4 feet away. A Dunnell Dean who was being submerged and uncovered by the waves. Johnny felt his arms being guided into safety line loops. Tension was being taken up on the line. His ears came free of the water, and he could hear. It was Dunnell Dean, a Dunnell Dean who was smiling, even though he was being doused repeatedly as the waves rolled past the cable ladder.
"Come on now, laddie," Dunnell Dean said. "Just hold on, and they'll pull you up to the plane. 'Tis a wee bit cold for a swim."
Chapter 15 1. Fleeting impressions half seen through a wall composed of darkness and pain. Dim consciousness of being in a ship and landing. Of someone spooning broth at him. Of being carried in a stretcher with rain on the blankets. Of a stone-walled room. Of different faces. Of whispered conversations. Of another stretcher. Of another plane. And a pain in his arm. He sank back into darkness. He thought he was in the drone again. He opened his eyes. He saw Dunnell Dean's face. He must still be in the sea. But no, he was not cold, he was warm.
"He's coming around," said someone softly. "We'll be able to operate soon."
He opened his eyes and saw boots and kilts, a lot of boots and kilts standing beside what he was lying on. A plane's motors? He was in a plane. He turned his head a little and it hurt, but there was Dunnell Dean's face. Johnny saw that he was on a sort of table. He was in a plane, a passenger plane. There was a tall gray man in a white coat on his left side. There were a lot of older Scots on his right side. Four young Scots were sitting on a bench. There was another table with some shiny things on it beyond the doctor. Dunaldin was sitting beside him, and there was a tube and a sort of pump connecting Dunaldin's arm with his own.
"What's this?"
whispered Johnny, indicating the tube, or trying to.
"Blood transfusion,"
said Dunaldin. He felt he should be very careful about what he said. He was smiling, but he was worried and felt very bad. Keep a bright face on it.
"Buddy, you are singularly fortunate. You are getting the royal blood of the Stuarts, no less, which puts you in direct line, after me, of course, to the throne of Scotland."
The doctor was signaling Dunaldin to take it easy. They all knew that Johnny might die, that there wasn't a 30% chance of his recovery, not with those two severe skull fractures and other injuries, as well as shock. His respiration was too shallow. In the underground hospital where they had operated for centuries, in a land where skull injuries were common, the doctor had seen too many die in less injured condition than this one. He was looking down at the big, handsome lad with something like pity.
"This is Dr. McKendrick," said Dunaldin to Johnny. "He'll handle you all right. You always overdo things, Johnny. Most would be content with one skull fracture, but not you, laddie. You've got two."
Dunaldin smiled.
"You'll be right as rain in no time."
He wished he could believe it. Johnny's face bore the gray of death.
"Maybe I should have waited for you in the drone if you were so close,"
whispered Johnny. The older Scots let out an incredulous gasp. Chief of Clan Fergus stepped forward.
No, Mac Tyler. The foul thing crashed just a mile north of Cape Wrath. 'Twas almost upon us."
"How did you find me?"
whispered Johnny.
"Laddie," said Dunaldin, "when you light a beacon fire to gather the clans, you don't do it halfway. The drone went up to 10,000 feet like a flaming rocket, and like to have lit the whole of Scotland. That's how we spotted ye."
The chief of the Argyles grumbled, "That wasn't what your companion told us, Dunaldin. They said your what-you-call-it detected a small object in the water, and then got a look on a plane, and then saw the fire." Dunaldin was very composed.
"It makes a better story that way, and that's the way the historian will write it. He lit a beacon fire in the sky."
The other chiefs nodded firmly. That was the way it should be.
"What day is this?"
whispered Johnny.
"Day 95.
Johnny felt a bit confused. He had lost a day. 2 days? Where had he been? Where was he? Why? The doctor saw puzzlement. He had seen it before in head injuries. This young man had lost track of time.
"They had to wait for me," he said. "I was not in Aberdeen at the moment. And then we had to type your blood and find someone with the same type. I'm sorry it took so long. But we also had to bring you out of shock, get you warm."
He shook his head sadly.
"I should have gone with you all along. I'll help the others when we get there."
This upset Johnny a little bit.
"Were there a lot of Scots hurt? You shouldn't have delayed for me if you had a doctor."
No, said the chief of the Camerons. "Dr. Allen, who's so expert with burns, was sent 2 days gone."
21 hurt, said Dunaldin. "The one being you. Only 2 died, very light casualties. The others will all recover."
"Who are they?"
whispered Johnny, making a slight motion with his hand to the 4 young men on the bench.
"Why, those," said Dunaldin, "are 4 members of the World Federation for the Unification of the Human Race. The first one is a MacDonald, and he speaks Russian now. The second is an Argyle, and he speaks German."
That wasn't why they were there at all. They were the others they'd found of Johnny's blood type, waiting in case more transfusions were needed.
"And why am I in a plane?"
whispered Johnny. That was the question they didn't want to answer. The doctor had told them not to worry this young man. They had him in a plane and were rushing him to the huge underground defense base in the mountains. There was some chance of a Cyclo counterattack. They had no idea at all whether the bombs sent to Cyclo had succeeded or failed.